Pioneering surgeries on 9 quadriplegic patients at Washington University School of Medicine have given those patients something they may only have dared hope for: movement. It's a nerve transfer surgery that has given patients limited movement in arms and fingers. The hope, of course, is that continued work may lead to restoring movement to other parts of the body. The technique is the subject of a film showing as part of the St. Louis International Film Festival. It's titled A Spark of Nerve. Joining me to discuss this work is Dr. Susan McKinnon, the Schoenberg Professor and Chief of the Division of Plastic and Reconstructive Surgery at the Washington University School of Medicine. She's featured in the film. She performed the first donor nerve transplant in 1988 and has developed a number of nerve transfer techniques since. She is considered a leading expert in her field. Doctor, thanks so much for being with us.
Great to be here.
You know, I think some people might be a little confused because plastic surgery is your field, not normally associated with the kind of work you've been doing.
That's a very interesting question. A short answer would be that plastic surgeons operate in the extremities, and orthopedic surgeons operate in the extremities, and those are the two big surgical specialties that work in the extremities, and that's where the nerves live. A longer question would be, I've been interested in nerves since I was a pre-med student, and I was interested in doing pediatric general surgery, but I was offered a job in plastic surgery if I would get trained in it. I wanted the job. I trained in plastic surgery. I thought, like you did, plastic surgery, really? I want to help people with problems, not make people look better that look fine to me. But plastic surgery, I found, is very, very reconstructive. And I trained with a chairman of neurosurgery, Alan Hudson, in Toronto, and I did an orthopedic hand fellowship in Baltimore at Union Memorial. And those three specialties, neurosurgery, plastic surgery, and orthopedic surgery, all touch the nerves. And all of those specialties have patients that need this type of thing.
There's been a lot of excitement about what's been going on most recently at Washington University with regard to the work with the quadriplegics. But your work predates that by some 25 years. What exactly was your work then, and how is it different from what's going on now?
A nerve traditionally, when it was injured, was just left alone, amputate the limb. It hurts and it has no movement and it has no sensation. Amputate the limb. It wasn't until the First and Second World Wars that we could even bring them together. And initially they were repaired. And then when you pulled too hard, they didn't work. And so people started in the late 60s, early 70s to put nerve splices in. And that was sort of the beginning of that nerve cadaver allotransplant that I did in 1998, was running out of nerve grafts and doing that. But what we found was that the results still weren't terrific with a nerve graft. And that was the stimulus to try something different. And that something different is you basically forget about where the injury is located. You look around where you want the function, down in the hand, for example, and you rob Peter to pay Paul. Robbing Peter to pay Paul is what reconstructive surgeons do all the time. You need a piece of bone, they'll take it from your hip and put it in your leg. You need a breast, they'll take it from your belly and put it up on your chest. So the nerve transfers came out of those couple of decades of pushing nerve grafts till they failed and then saying something must be better. And the nerve transfers can be absolutely spectacular. So the nerve transfers in the nerve-injured patients was the impetus to try that in the spinal cord patient.
It's rerouting the nerve path, correct?
That's right.
And as I understand it, and I don't understand much, I mean, it's way, way out of my league, but what is happening with regard to sending a message to the brain to move that thumb or move that index finger?
The brain is such a good friend of ours because we can do our human repair and then the brain can make it look terrific. The brain is very interested in, if possible, making the most of what we have. And when we can take a nerve that, for example, flexes or bends or makes a fist and move it over to the other side of the arm to do the opposite, straighten the fingers and the wrist up. Doesn't that seem incredible? Mm-hmm. The brain can make that work almost seamlessly, so you wouldn't even know. So the brain connects to the spinal cord, connects to the nerves, connects to the muscles, and we just take advantage of that. We take advantage of that with the really terrific physical therapists.
I don't want to digress too much, but what I'm thinking when you're talking here is, when there is an amputation and the brain still thinks that the leg is there, is this kind of the brain compensating somehow, sort of a similar kind of thing?
Well, there are colleagues that are working on patients with amputations to try to harness the connection brain, spinal cord, nerve, nerve cut, nothing there, to use that neural impetus to motor prosthetics. And a lot of people have seen someone sitting at a table and thinking, I'd like that can of Coke, and over there the Coke moves towards the prosthetic hand and they drink the can of Coke. So the power of the brain is really incredible. Yeah. We take advantage of that as well.
And we're learning so much more about it with each passing day, aren't we? In your early surgeries, my understanding was that you were dealing with donor nerves. Is that correct?
Well, in the time after we found nerve repairs only worked in such situations where there was no tension. And then we were moving into, well, what if there is tension? What if you've lost a chunk of nerve? That's when we moved into nerve splicing or nerve grafts. And we would take a nerve graft from typically the lower leg where you don't need it, lose some sensation on the side of the foot, and use that as the graft or the splice. But then we started to do the same thing, what humans do. We kept pushing it longer, longer, more and more. And that's when I started the research on what we call nerve allotransplantation. That is, go to a cadaver and take expendable graft from a dead cadaver. And I tell you, 10 years or more of a lot of research on that. And what we found was that we could make those cadaver grafts work better than your own graft because we were giving you immunosuppression, which helps the nerves regenerate. But we still weren't knocking the ball out of the park. It still wasn't like, oh, I have to sit down. That result is so great. And that happens now with nerve transfers. It did not happen with nerve grafts.
With the donor nerves, is there a chance of rejection as there might be for an organ?
There's huge chance of rejection, and that was what all the research was to stop the rejection. The nerves aren't as antigenic or as foreign as other tissues, and the work that we actually did do with all those years and expensive NIH dollars has translated into hand transplants and face transplants because those are motored by the nerves. So all of that work we did on that nerve regeneration has been acceptated and flipped right into that area of research, which is terrific. But for an injury that a human might have up in the armpit where someone might take a lymph node biopsy and take the nerve instead, we don't go up to the armpit now for reconstruction. We go down to the hand, down to the forearm, and raw Peter to pay Paul, move expendable nerves away to an area where you need it. We're built with 2 hands, 10 fingers, 2 eyes, 2 ears, 2 of a lot of things for a reason. And when we were able to get inside the nerve and look inside the nerve, we saw that same redundancy. So, for example, there's 3 tendons that make your wrist go up. You only need 1. And when you look inside a nerve, there is that expendable component of nerve as well. That's enormous. It's breathtaking when we're operating to see that we have that ability to get inside the nerve, take something from one nerve, and move it somewhere else where you need it.
How big is a nerve? I mean, I think it's like a violin string, if that thick.
They basically come in 2 sizes, one about the size of that pencil, and then one about half the size of this little wire here.
Uh-huh.
The sciatic nerve in your leg is about the size of my thumb. Now you're not going to be so impressed, but within the median nerve at the wrist, the carpal tunnel, it's about the size of a pencil. It has 30,000 nerve fibers, and they're bundled together in about 30 groups. And so I wanted you to be impressed, but now you think it's easy.
No, believe me, I don't think it's easy. But I did think that we're dealing with something that was microscopic, that you'd have to use some magnification to get at.
Well, if you took the pencil that's over on your desk, the lead of that pencil is about the diameter of the phrenic nerve, which runs your diaphragm. And if you lose both phrenic nerves, you're on a ventilator. Mm-hmm. So that small size is incredibly powerful for function. The nerve that would run your elbow, your biceps, would be about that size and a half more. But within that, there's 3,000 nerve fibers, rather. So it goes to different levels. It gets very, very small, but we work at a larger level.
Our bodies are really quite remarkable things, aren't they?
Amazing.
Really is. This is fascinating to learn how this works. Let's go back to your early days in this and bring it up to the present. What were you able to accomplish with what you were doing 25 years ago in terms of establishing movement where there was none, compared to what you can do today?
Well, it was pretty sad, but it was better than nothing, and I was pretty happy about it. Now when I look back at, you know, plastic surgeons were always taking pictures and showing them at meetings and things like that, so I have pictures of the results, and when I look at them now, I think that's really not very good. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the look on the patient's face, they're not that happy. But I took those results because after 2 or 3 years, I'd get the elbow to bend. So that would be a typical result with an injury in the upper arm, pretty common off motorcycles or car accidents. We would do an operation that would be 10 to 15 hours long, and we'd wait 2 or 3 years, and then the elbow would bend.
To an arm that had otherwise been paralyzed.
And we'd be thrilled. Mm-hmm. But now, you know, 9 months, we're getting the same results we get in 2 years, and at 2 years, it's almost normal with respect to elbow flexion. Now, all the nerve transfers are different, and trying to get the shoulder to work, which is such a complicated twist in a circle, that's more challenging than just the elbow to bend. But some of the results with the nerve transfers are absolutely spectacular. Here's another reason why. You can lose a lot of nerve fibers before you lose function. This is another gift that we've been given. You can lose 10% of the nerve fibers all the way down to almost 80% of the nerve fibers and still maintain normal function. So the bar is relatively low for us to deliver. If we can get something across the finish line and it's just above that 20 to 30% demand, we can show normal function.
From what I understand, and again, I'm such a layperson when it comes to this, but I've been reading in advance of your coming here, the therapy that is involved, I mean, it's just ongoing, extensive, and takes an extremely long time to see any progress at all.
No. it's not so gloomy as that at all. I guess when you're saying, well, I would wait 2 years and get a kind of lousy result, and now I wait a year and I get a good result, and then that continues over the next year to be almost a normal result. That's terrific, especially when these injuries tend to occur in young people. But back to that therapy, the physical therapist and some occupational therapists, they're really, really trained in it. And if, as a surgeon, you can put your hands behind your back and stand back and let the therapist do their job instead of telling them how to do the job, let them do the job and let them invent, if you will, and innovate on this, the results with their therapy would make surgeons look so much better all the time.
What I had read, and I'm just looking at my notes here to make sure that I'm not totally off base, it's extensive therapy for the brain to accept the transfer.
My therapist, Lorna Kahn, who rehabs my patients and my partner's patients, she says, Susan, you build the car, but I've got the owner's manual. I tell them how to turn it on. So she will teach them on the normal side what the transfers have been. If you're taking this nerve to that nerve, she'll teach them on the normal side how to co-contract those movements. And then she'll go over to the side where we've operated on, and she'll say, now, move the donor. So if the donor did fist, then you move the donor, and now the donor, when you fist, it makes your elbow bend. So it doesn't take very long for the brain to pick that up.
What's the most dramatic case you've seen in terms of improvement?
Well, you know, I see patients 2 days a week. And, well, when we did Dr. Wachtel with this first spinal cord nerve transfer, that was five and a half.
I'm not familiar with it. Smile cord?
Spinal cord.
Spinal
cord. When we did that transfer 5.5 years ago, and it was the same operation I'd done on several patients that had nerve injuries in the arm. The trying to give someone hand function when they had no hand function, stole a nerve from above the elbow you don't need and sewed it into the nerve to give you hand function, hand grip.
Was this a quadriplegic
this was
case?
These were on non-quadriplegic, peripheral nerve patients. So I'd done it and I knew it worked. And then this quadriplegic, Dr. Wachtel, came to my office and I did that operation on him. And when he got his result, when we got a phone call from his hand therapist who was helping him with this in Arizona and said he can eat now, he can pick up something and feed himself, I was in clinic. I fell down on the floor.
Oh, wow. Sure.
I fell to the floor. I was so excited.
Great.
I don't fall to the floor too often, but that was pretty exciting. that was very exciting because it was something I know will work. It's challenging, difficult surgery to do. You have to know what you're doing. You have to pick the right patient because they're fragile. They have to be able healthy enough to do it. But I know that this is going to mean a lot in the future for that patient population.
I want to talk about that. There was another example I read about that a quadriplegic who had some surgery and was able to pick a noodle off his chest.
With my partner in this project, Ida Fox, that was her experience. But that Dr. Wachtel went out to dinner with his wife in Las Vegas. They live in Arizona, in Phoenix. He went out to dinner on their 50th wedding anniversary. And prior to that, he couldn't feed himself, so he wouldn't go out to dinner. But one of the things that people will say is that if they can do something as simple as that, like a noodle drops on your chest and you don't have to sit there with a noodle on your chest, you can pick it up and put it on your plate. Those kinds of things are breathtaking for them.
Oh, and breathtaking for the rest of us, too, who think that this is even possible. I want to talk about where we're going, but we have a call here that might be relevant at this point. We'll bring in Dennis from Overland with a quick question, I hope, Dennis.
Yeah, Don, I personally have a dropped foot, and I'm wondering, you know, whether there might be hope.
What is a dropped foot is I think everybody's seen them. They walk and they'll lift the knee up because the ankle won't dorsiflex or the ankle won't clear the floor. Mm-hmm. And so they're flapping along like that. So the first thing that I want to know when I hear from someone like our caller is if you can turn your ankle in, then you're without even examining you, if you've got power to turn your ankle in towards the great toe side of your foot, then you would be a candidate for a tendon transfer and you would get out of your splint. So that's one thing. The second thing is that there is a compression point on the peroneal nerve which gives the drop foot at the knee, and it is very under-recognized as something that is very simple to fix with just a little nerve release there. So we are looking at that whole idea in the falls population as a component of falling. And we've got a lot of bright residents and medical students in our division who are working on that right now.
Well, Dennis, there you go. Hope there's something there that can help you improve your situation.
Yes, that's very encouraging.
Great. Thank you so much.
Now, can I say, Dennis, if you do have that where your ankle can go in, and I can't help you with this little operation at the knee, there's some excellent foot and ankle orthopedic surgeons at WashU that have got a lot of experience in that tendon transfer.
Okay. Well, I had a back operation that took care of the pain going down to the foot. But yes, this is encouraging. I thank you very much.
And Dennis, thank you for the call. Well, let's talk about where this is taking us. Dare we hope that someone who is a quadriplegic today, perhaps in their lifetime, might be able to have movement restored over a great percentage of their body?
Well, dare we hope, and a lot of neuroscientists are working at that, not just hoping it'll happen, but devoting their whole careers to that. And if my opinion is that if you have a bad problem like that and you are willing to devote your career to it, if not your career, someone else that you're training's career will fix that. That is a problem that people aren't giving up on. And my area of research in our laboratory is not the spinal cord, it's the peripheral nerve. We're thrilled to be able to take the knowledge that we have from the peripheral nerve. And when we're operating on these patients, we're in the peripheral nerve. We're out in the extremity. We're bypassing the spinal cord just the same way we bypass a high nerve injury up in the arm. And we're moving nerves around in the arm because the nerves below the spinal cord injury are healthy. At the injury, they're not. Above the injury, they're healthy and they talk to the brain. So we're just rerouting a new connection to those healthy nerves. But people, not myself, but spinal cord researchers are working on that, and they won't stop until they get it right.
Would you think that this is something that will be achieved in our lifetime? Well, your lifetime, perhaps.
Well, I gave a lecture to the first-year med students yesterday on this type of thing because they've just finished their nerve anatomy, Jane and Glenn Conway, who run the anatomy, want us to come in and say how clinically applicable would be. So the questions the medical students came up afterwards were, well, what about controlling bladder function, and what about controlling bowel function, and what about lower extremity? And each one of those things, that's a lifetime of slow, hard work, major funding from our grant organizations. But if you stay focused, you're going to get the answer. It's just a question of when you're going to get it.
And that does so much to restore the dignity of a patient, doesn't it, to have those functions restored?
And not only the dignity of the patient, but everyone that loves them. And it gives hope back to every one of their friends and family.
We've talked mostly about the arms and elbows and fingers. What about legs? What sort of advances and what sort of progress has been made there?
Some, but not as much. And the injuries in the upper extremity are probably more common. And if I think all of us would give up a leg before we'd give up a hand. So there's more need from that point of view just to look after yourself, just to drink and feed. There are some nerve transfers done in the lower extremity, and some of my colleagues in our division, Dr. Tung and Dr. Moore, are specifically looking at that. In fact, yesterday they just did a nerve transfer lower extremity, but it's farther away than the upper extremity.
This is remarkable stuff. Dr. Susan McKinnon, thank you so much for being with us. I'll remind folks that the St. Louis International Film Festival will present A Spark of Nerve, which is about the kind of things that we're talking about here. That's going to happen Monday, November 9th at 5:05 p.m. at the Tivoli Theater in University City. And our guest, Dr. Susan McKinnon, is featured in that film. Have you seen it?
I have.
And?
Oh, Oscar quality for sure.
Well, I hope a lot of people see it. Thank you so much, Doctor, for being with us.
Thank you, Don.
That's it for us for today. Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk with Nick Barardini about his documentary examining the use and safety of tasers used in law enforcement. Then we'll take a look at a documentary following six pit bulls rescued after Michael Vick's dogfighting conviction. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio 90.7 KWMU. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.